It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We turn to a Wisconsin voice in fashion trend forecasting, the process of identifying new trends and how they'll shape the ever-changing fashion industry. So as we discuss trend reports and what they say about the items that you wear, call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen Schmidt is on the faculty of Odessa School of Fashion in Milwaukee, will teach fashion forecasting in the spring, and is back in Wisconsin after years in New York City working with labels like Todd Snyder, Banana Republic, and Ralph Lauren. Kristen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Take us on a bit of a tour of your style predictions for 2024. What's in store? What are some themes?
Well, trend forecasting itself like follows three things, right? Like it has a curve like everything else. There's a rise, there's a peak, and there's a fall. So an example right now is low-rise jeans seem to be coming back in. So they're on the rise. Get it? Pun intended. And but I wouldn't necessarily say that high-rise jeans are out. It seems like they're holding steady at this point, but they might be just at that top of the curve and starting to go down. But what I'm seeing for next year to cover color and silhouette and technology, it looks like brown is our color of the season, and big shoulders and attitude are coming in. So what that means is brown is a color that everybody loves and is really comfortable with right now. It is not being lauded as Pantone's color of the year, but it is a comforting color. It's also a neutral. It works really well with bright colors, etc. And as for the big shoulders, I think we're coming into, is that a bit of a vintage 80s thing, but is it also like a confidence and a boldness of leaving the house after the pandemic? And what I've been reading is that attitude is going to be a strong thing for 2024. And they have used the word rage, and I hope that does not show up. I hope that is wrong.
Oh, wow. How would that translate on the runway?
I think what that means is more punk, you know, leaning toward maybe more asymmetrical and harder silhouettes, like, as I said, like the big shoulders, and maybe we have more piercings and the mixed of plaids, etc.
What do you make of this optimism for brown and this attraction to brown? What's going on there?
I mean, I personally feel ready for it. Like starting last year, I was looking at brown things in my wardrobe and wanting to wear them. As far as how that happens in a global trend, I think it's, you know, it's cyclical. And to be fair, every color is on trend all the time. It's just there's always a variation within that. Like brown a couple of years ago was trending in a camel version. And now the darker brown is what people are leaning toward. It's kind of like an acid green would reflect your 80s green. But right now, green is big in olives and in your pines and even like the mossier colors.
I think it's interesting you point out those distinctions. And it leads us to wonder, can style predictions be localized to different regions, perhaps different regions of the world or different regions of the U.S.? How does that work?
Well, trend forecasting comes from the big fashion cities, right? Like Paris, Milan,
London,
and
New York.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that fashion brands are designing just for those people, right? Like the fashion brands are designing for us. They're designing for Wisconsin. And when I'm on a design team or a concept team or a product development team, I've been on all three parts of those, we talk about hot stores. So those would be the stores in the South that we're designing for. But Wisconsin is the same latitude as New York, right? So everything we design is for this same climate. An example would be you design for northern climate, and let's say we have a cashmere cable sweater. Miami is not going to do very well with that, even in February. And so we would sell perhaps a lighter weight version of it with short sleeves. But translating it to locations, there's a lot of data that we get from our customers. Like if Banana Republic puts a red skirt in the store at Bayshore and it sells off, and the blue sits there until it goes to markdown, Banana will punish you and there will be no blue skirts next year.
Oh my goodness. It makes me wonder, what happens to designers and labels when their forecasts are off? Like what their when their collection for fall or summer just misses the mark.
I think that's so detrimental to most brands because runway is very different than what you will see in the store. Runway, if it's off, it doesn't matter. You get a bad review, move on. And I mean, it matters, but what's in the store is always going to be analyzed by a ton of data. Like the first thing that a company is going to do is analyze the consumer data, right? There is no such thing as a trend without a customer. And so we would analyze this size range sells best here, and this location doesn't like patterns on their shirts. They prefer solids. And we know all of that data through the sales marks at each register by zip code. And that's kept in mind for the year of design.
Talking fashion trends with Kristen Schmidt, fashion forecasting instructor at Odessa School of Fashion in Milwaukee. You can join in with your questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Kristen, with all of this data, can we talk about artificial intelligence in fashion forecasting? How some AI models are used to analyze the latest designs to find patterns and style and color. What do you see with AI? Do you use AI as a tool in your work?
I do not. No, I don't use that at all. Like so far, the companies that I freelance with and work with, we use the traditional trend service houses, not because we're not early adapters, but because perhaps those trend services are not necessarily using that yet.
And when
We
you
use
say
online.
trend service houses, what do you mean by that?
There are companies whose sole job is to analyze trends. And these geniuses take a big worldview, right? Like they look at politics and military actions and attitudes and climate and big things that are going on in the world and oil prices. And they will put forward a prediction of the trends, starting with color and perhaps weeding down to silhouette. So a trend service house they'll set up a report based on their inspirations that they're seeing that are trending in the world. Like maybe ceramic art has become a thing that most museums are showing instead of oil paintings. And then that will show up in that report. And a brand will take that down and translate it to how it applies to each customer.
Wow. And so you take that kind of information to inform where you take garments and colors and collections. Do you see, though, AI as part of the future of fashion forecasting?
I would assume so. Yeah. I mean, it seems inevitable that AI is literally going to take over much of what we do. I could see it functioning very well, like the ability to quickly analyze mega data and filter that into micro data.
Kristen Schmidt, fashion forecasting instructor at Odessa School of Fashion in Milwaukee, with us, has insights on the fashion industry and what Wisconsinites will like to wear now and in the future. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the work of interpreting and curating fashion trends well into the future and how those trends speak to what we pull out of our closets here in Wisconsin. As we discuss fashion forecasting, call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Kristen Schmidt, forecasting instructor at Odessa School of Fashion in Milwaukee. Kristen, twice a year, cities across the world host runway shows for Fashion Week. How do trends in fashion-focused cities like Paris and London and Milan make their way into Midwest fashion?
Well, in the advent of social media and online shopping and the internet, which obviously is not a new thing anymore, but it's not like other cities are in a black hole anymore. Like, everything is available at our fingertips. Right now we're seeing this trend of all these nude dresses, right? Like, literally sheer dresses where you are seeing breasts and butts and everything. And it's arguably beautiful on a celebrity on the runway, right? That's inappropriate, perhaps, for a brand like Ann Taylor, but a way that you could scratch that itch for the customer is to make a version of it with a filmy fabric, little see-through, but have a full lining underneath so there is full coverage with the appearance of being sheer. Like, that's how those things can translate down. Mm-hmm. But as for Wisconsin specifically, I've been working in New York, but remote from Wisconsin the last couple of years. And the last few years, I've been working with Todd Snyder, and he is the reigning king of collaborations. And when I first came on board, there was a launch of a collaboration with our very own Harley Davidson in Milwaukee.
Ah.
There's a global view, but then there's also that local view, like being able to pull a cool brand like Harley Davidson into a collaboration was really huge. And Milwaukee obviously was already on the map, but it made it even more so.
What influence did Harley have, though, on the designing of Todd Snyder? Like, how do those two intersect?
So the Harley team would pull from the archive. I wasn't part of this collaboration, mm-hmm. but the Harley team would pull from the archives and work closely with the Todd Snyder team on what they want. When there's a collaboration like that, it has to be legally approved and aesthetically approved on both ends. And it's just about putting the best foot forward of what the concept is. And they chose to do some vintage logos and vintage embroidery. And a lot of it was like knits and sweatshirts and stuff, but there was like a fantastic coverall
look. Yeah. Does Wisconsin have a distinct style? Does anything stand out here?
It's a good question. I think we are really good at two things that are trending right now. Like, puffers are a huge trend, right? So we need to be taking advantage of that and dressing for the season. When it's cold outside, don't wear your mini skirt and little nylons. Please wear a puffer. And right now the puffer is out in asymmetry, giant shapes, super voluminous. Like, that's a thing that I've seen walking down the streets of Milwaukee now that it's getting a little colder. And also a big trend right now is visible mending. And the Midwest, we are the land of crafting. I think this is something we're really good at and an early adopter. So visible mending is the pride of keeping a garment with a tear and stitching with contrast stitch or putting a patch on it, something overt that shows that you are recycling or upcycling or remaking your own garment.
Oh, that's fascinating. My kids, they returned from a weekend in Chicago and said that people that they saw there on the streets, and you talked about walking on the streets of Milwaukee, I mean, as they walked on the streets in Chicago, they said, "Mom, they dress differently there than what they see here in Madison." And I'm just wondering, now that we're talking, is there anything to that?
Probably. I mean, you dress like your friends, right? Like, mm-hmm. at some point, you look like your friends. We use the same hairdressers. We do the same shopping. We trade clothes. So I think that makes sense that even within smaller locations, just 100 miles apart, that you would see different things. Yes.
And incidentally, they said they saw lots of jeans and lots of people wearing black clothes.
That's always in trend. That's beautiful. Okay, yeah.
Well, let's take a call now. Jane is here in New York. Jane, hi.
Hi,
Jane. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi, Kristen. I have a question for you.
Hi, Jane.
How do you predict local cultural influences will shape fashion trends in Wisconsin over the next year?
So local cultural influences and the impact on fashion trends in Wisconsin.
That's a hard one to answer. Well, I think, I mean, globally, we have a couple things coming on, right? Like we have the Olympics coming up. And so locally, I definitely expect to see that influence us. I mean, Wisconsin's such a big Packers state and Brewers state and athletic state. And I think we're going to be all over that trend, like adding some athletic wear and promoting the U.S. team.
Kristen Schmidt with us, fashion forecasting instructor at Odessa School of Fashion in Milwaukee, taking us through the crystal ball a bit in fashion. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Kristen, you mentioned the sporting world, and we need to have a heart-to-heart about athleisure. And this hits close to home as I look down at my leggings right now. So will athleisure as a style keep going strong in 2024?
I think once people got comfortable in their leggings and sweatpants, that it's going to be very hard to tear away from that. So the overarching trend that we call that is cozy. So where we were in the house and allowed to wear sweatpants or whatever you wanted from your waist down while we were Zooming, I think now that we're outside, it's looking more like elastic waist trousers. So you could have a pair of dress pants that have a drawstring or an elastic waist, something comfortable. And that's fabrics with stretch, things that allow more movement.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I see that.
you're like, I'm keeping my leggings.
I'm keeping my leg. Yes, and also wondering at the same time, is Lululemon considered luxury, and why are its leggings so expensive?
Oh.
Asking for a friend.
Well, oh boy. Talking about expense in garments, it's so difficult without knowing the inner structure of like a company's specific IMU goals and the prices of their fabrics. I personally don't have Lululemon leggings, so I couldn't even really analyze that for you. But in general, that is going to be about the volume of your buy. If you buy 1,000 pieces across 4 colors, it's going to be less expensive than buying 20 pieces in one color because of minimums and the way the factories are set up and run. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that they have proprietary fabrics with innovative stretch, et cetera, that may just cost more.
Okay. Well, I understand if it's not leggings, sweaters are, you know, kind of your sweet spot here. So based on your experience with sweaters, what are the best sweater materials for living in Wisconsin?
Ooh. Well, merino wool is a fantastic fiber. Because if it's fine enough, if you have extra fine merino wool, it will not be itchy because the staple length or that length of the fiber that comes off of the sheep is longer. And the amazing thing about wool is if you wear a wool garment, wool socks even, and lay it out overnight after a day of wear, it will refresh itself overnight. It does not need to be laundered regularly. It does not need to be dry cleaned regularly. It is sort of a naturally antimicrobial thing. I'm always going to push cashmere because it is so lovely and so soft and really has no itch factor. There's tricks with cashmere though. A lot of the lofty and soft ones that you feel in the store are knit on a looser tension and they could pill. And it's just something that you learn through practice. But
Really quickly here, because we're almost out of time, what is best to wear under sweaters?
Oh, tank top.
Okay. We can go for that. Oh, well, Kristen, this was so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Kristen Schmidt is on the faculty of Odessa School of Fashion in Milwaukee. And if you missed any part of this conversation or wish to hear other conversations, we have got a great place to visit. Go to our program page at WPR.org/mornings. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Policy Forum publishes dozens of in-depth reports this year examining key issues in our state, from marijuana access to early childhood care economics. We explore the top findings for 2023. But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with the history of a popular Christmas song and its ties to Wisconsin.
When I was a kid, one of my favorite holiday songs was The 12 Days of Christmas. My brother and I would sing that song at the top of our lungs late into the night on Christmas Eve in anticipation of the gifts for us under the tree. But did you know that the first lyrics for the song were published in London in 1780, and that in the northern counties of England, the song was often called the 10 Days of Christmas, as there were only 10 gifts? And did you know that the 12 Days of Christmas has a Wisconsin connection? Meg Jones explains.
Whatever you think of the song, The 12 Days of Christmas, you can thank or blame a Milwaukee professor for bringing the holiday carol across the Atlantic Ocean. Emily Frances Brown was an English professor at Milwaukee Downer College. She organized and wrote annual Christmas productions at the all-women school. While browsing in a bookstore in Oxford, England, she discovered the sheet music for a holiday song called The 12 Days of Christmas. She bought it, tucked it into her luggage, and brought it back to Milwaukee in 1910. That year, Brown's students first sang about partridges and pear trees, French hens, lords a-leaping, and five gold rings during the annual Christmas concert. They sang it the next year and the year after that. At some point, the song spread. Now, it's a bit of a stretch to say it went viral, but eventually it became part of America's collective holiday songbook. It wasn't unusual for European music to make its way to America via travelers such as Brown. Some came with immigrants who brought their instruments, choir books, and music traditions from their home countries, and some songs came as souvenirs picked up by music-loving tourists. The origin of The 12 Days of Christmas is uncertain, but many music scholars agree the melody is French, and the lyrics probably came from 18th century England. Just why it caught on while other holiday songs did not is anyone's guess. The tune gets renewed attention each year when the annual estimate of the cost of each item in the song is released as a humorous economic indicator. The cost goes up and down depending on the economy, rising paychecks for dancers and drummers, a boost in the federal minimum wage for maids of milking, and volatile swan prices. In recent years, the 12 Days of Christmas gifts totaled a whopping $34,000. But if you exclude purchasing swans, you'll only have to shell out around $23,000. Brown herself was a bit mystified by the song's popularity. She had no idea that a song celebrating excessive gift-giving would one day become so popular. In a 1957 letter to a former Downer student, she downplayed her part in bringing the infernal song to America. She wrote that she simply picked up a printed carol in the Oxford shop, brought it home to Wisconsin, and first used it at a dinner in Holton Hall in December 1910. The next year, it was used for a celebration of the 100th anniversary of Charles Dickinson's birth and repeated the following December. Brown taught at Milwaukee Downer College for 35 years until 1945. She died in 1958. the Downer College buildings are now part of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Downer College merged with Lawrence University in Appleton, where Brown's papers are archived. Among her memorabilia is that sheet music she bought on a jaunt to England more than a century ago.
Meg Jones brought us that history on the 12 Days of Christmas and was a longtime reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She passed away in 2020. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As 2023 comes to a close, we explore a nonpartisan organization's top research findings. The Wisconsin Policy Forum published more than 50 reports on statewide issues this year. Join in by calling with your question, your comments on state and local government, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jason Stein is Vice President and Research Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Good to be here.
All right. So 54 research papers and policy briefs, about 20 focus on finances for state and local government. What are researchers learning about the budget challenges facing public services in our state?
This year was a year where both state and local government were able to take on additional challenges. You know, there was a very large $7 billion general fund surplus going into the state budget this year. It led to a historic increase in state aid to local governments and at least a, you know, healthy increase in school funding, although it fell somewhat short when you combine state and local funding for schools. It fell somewhat short of inflation. So it was definitely a year where more resources went out from the state to the local level. At the same time, though, we still see some school districts and local governments that, depending on how the state chose to allocate that money, may not be doing as well. So some small towns got tremendous influxes of aid from the state budget, but let's say a community like Madison with relatively high property values and a large population did not. So it does vary by community, kind of what level of aid the local government is seeing, but statewide as a whole, on average, more.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is that the state's shared revenue program was certainly one of the key developments this year. And, you know, the analysis that you did on the potential impact for communities, you also mentioned the state's big budget surplus. I wonder, how has that informed what you decide to analyze as a research organization, or how does that factor into what you decide to look at with state coffers?
No, I think probably the biggest way is we're always looking, Kate, at the problems that Wisconsinites face, whether it's our relatively high incarceration rates or, you know, we have relatively high racial disparities for youth in education, for example, on some other metrics. You know, sometimes some years we have to look at those problems and think, you know, how can the state address them? You know, let's say challenges with our roads, and how can the state address those merely with the resources that it has right now, right? Mm. Which means that there are limits. You know, this year, I think it was more credible for us to provide some options for how spending could be increased or how taxes could be decreased because, you know, although the surplus isn't infinite, it was pretty big. And it did allow the state to take on some new challenges that it hadn't in the past.
One of the studies from the year found Wisconsin ranks last in the nation for spending on state park operations. What is driving this disparity?
You know, the biggest thing there, I mean, we do have a relatively robust park system, despite being dead last in either per capita spending on state parks or spending per visit. And you know, what is driving that? I think more than anything, it's the fact that over the past generation, Wisconsin has pulled all of its state tax dollar support out of the park system. So, you know, in the mid-90s, let's say like 1994, state law would have required that the state pay for half of the operations with state parks with, you know, income and sales tax dollars and other general fund taxes that the state takes in. Today, the state doesn't put any tax money into its parks. The parks are purely financed with essentially with user fees. And so, you know, there's various factors, but I think that's one of the most significant ones in terms of why parks have seen such a change.
So, how could Wisconsin, better fund its conservation, better fund its state parks?
Sure. Well, I mean, certainly within the park system, the state could make a policy choice to provide some tax funding to the parks. It's not a huge budget in the context of the larger state finances. So, with the you know, in the state, although we got a budget deal, the governor vetoed some income tax provisions put in by Republicans, and so. And Republicans and Evers can't agree, at least so far, on whether to spend money on childcare, which is something we could also talk about. So there's still about a $4 billion projected surplus for the state at the end of this 2-year budget. So they certainly could put some money into state parks. You know, another option for policymakers would be to simply provide more services within the park system that the parks could essentially get user fees for. So an example would be in Michigan, they have cabins in their state parks. I've actually stayed at some of them. They're pretty nice. And you could do the same within some of Wisconsin parks, and that would be additional revenue for the system. You could do things like that.
Jason Stein with us, Vice President and Research Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, a nonpartisan think tank publishing dozens of reports this year. Be part of the conversation. Call in with your questions, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We tour through Wisconsin Policy Forum's top research findings of the year from dozens of reports and policy briefs the organization published this year. Call in with your questions, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Wisconsin Policy Forum Research Director Jason Stein stays with us. Jason, we spoke with State Superintendent Jill Underley this week to reflect on 2023. And let's listen to Underley talking about teacher retention rates.
We don't have necessarily a recruitment problem. We have a retention problem. They'll stay in teaching for, you know, a few years, but then realize, you know, that the private sector is paying more.
So what is the Policy Forum's analysis on teacher turnover?
Well, we did an analysis of data from 2009 to 2023, and we found that teacher turnover rate in the final year in 2023, the most recent year, reached 15.8%, which was the highest in all the data we analyzed. And we found that that was generally being driven by teachers leaving public school classrooms. So that might be to at least public school classrooms in Wisconsin. So that might be to retire, to go teach in a different state, to take a different job outside of teaching, whether that's administration within a public school or, you know, something in the private sector. And so that's certainly something to watch. Turnover has been very high in many professions, not just education, and it may improve as the economy shifts. But certainly, we saw a pretty substantial turnover rate in the most recent year, and it's something for policymakers to consider.
What did you find in the data about turnover among teachers of color?
So, you know, obviously the rate that I was giving you before was just a statewide average. Mm-hmm. And so it really varies. And so there's higher turnover rates for teachers of color compared to white teachers within districts serving vulnerable student populations. So, you know, student populations, students of color or low-income students, as well as small rural school districts, also had very high rates of turnover. So it's a statewide problem, but more so in some districts than others.
Let's take a call now. Jeff joining us from Superior. Hi, Jeff. What is your question?
Hi, good morning. When I look at the Wisconsin state flag or the state seal, I see, you know, the man standing there representing agriculture, but I also see shipping, maritime industry. And I wonder if you could expand on the idea of the impact of the shipping industry in Wisconsin. I know Congressman Tiffany talks about it a lot.
Jeff, thank you. Did your research insights take you into the shipping industry, Jason?
I'll be completely honest that that's not something that I have greatly looked at. I do think that we're a manufacturing and agricultural state, and so shipping is essential for us to be able to move goods, because those are both, you know, export-oriented industries. You know, for Wisconsin, I think having adequate infrastructure to be able to support those industries, it ranges from everything from barges on the Mississippi and ocean-going vessels that come in to the Great Lakes through the St. Lawrence Seaway, as well as, you know, rail and highway infrastructure. There was certainly a very healthy infrastructure spending that happened in the state budget this year within the transportation fund, but we don't really as yet have a sustainable funding method for that, because the traditional transportation and infrastructure funding tools that we have as a state, like gas taxes and vehicle registrations, have been lagging. And the state has been putting income and sales tax dollars, which would normally go to like healthcare and education, things like that. The state has been substituting those income and sales tax dollars in recent years, which has been okay because the state has been flush. But at a certain point, you know, in the future, the economy is going to tighten. The state's not going to have those excess tax dollars in its general fund, and it's going to be harder to fund infrastructure. So I think, you know, that's something that we're actually giving some thought for in 2024 at the policy forum, is looking at options for policymakers to try and resolve that long-term challenge.
Put it on the idea list for analysis in 2024. Yep. Let's turn to childcare. In May, Wisconsin Policy Forum examining the economics of early childhood education and care in Milwaukee County. What are you learning about these services?
Sure. So when we looked at this issue, we found that in Milwaukee County, annual cost of childcare at that time, 2022, $12,000 for a four-year-old, more than $16,000 for an infant. You know, that's striking because it's more expensive than in-state tuition at any University of Wisconsin campus. And it's also for the four-year-old about more than a fifth of the median household income in Milwaukee County. And for an infant, it's nearly a third. So when you think about families also needing housing, health care, food, all the other necessities of life, that makes it very challenging. At the same time, childcare workers are typically paid very low, and there can also be challenges for the childcare operator themselves to, you know, remain viable as a business.
And we saw Governor Evers, pushing the childcare counts grants to help keep facilities open and as a way to help, you know, stop the tuition increases. What did your findings say there?
Well, you're exactly right that the state has been sort of propping up the system for the last several years with federal stimulus money, pandemic stimulus money. That money's running out. And so the governor and lawmakers have been talking about what is a, you know, sort of sustainable solution there. They haven't reached one. The governor has advocated for, you know, direct subsidies from the state. You know, there could be other options like tax credits for childcare that would go to families. But, you know, I think there's long term, there's still something that needs to be sorted out from a policy standpoint to ensure that, you know, parents are able to drop their kids off at daycare and join the workforce where we have, you know, very low unemployment rates right now.
Jason Stein with us, research director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, as we look at key takeaways on published research in 2023. You can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. On marijuana policy, researchers found half of Wisconsin residents 21 and older live within a 75-minute drive of legal marijuana access due to recreational use, you know, becoming legal in Illinois and Michigan. What could Wisconsin policymakers take away from this research?
Sure. And this was something that we published in February, which was before Minnesota went from having legal medical marijuana to legal recreational marijuana. So, you know, we now have, as you say, like nearly more than half of Wisconsinites able to drive to a dispensary within 75 minutes. I think, you know, we don't advocate for or against legalization, but I think the reality for policymakers is to understand that much of the population of Wisconsin has pretty ready access to this drug. And, you know, that with all the challenges of enforcement and the loss of potential tax revenues to the state that entails. So, you know, it's one of these situations where the legislature has been very reluctant to approve the substance in Wisconsin. But at the same time, it's certainly making inroads here despite that.
In our waning seconds here, what does the policy forum have its eye on? What theme in 2024? Can you give us any type of hint or preview?
You know, I mean, I think the workforce, childcare and workforce issues are going to continue to be important. We're looking at education issues in Milwaukee, as well as the possible expansion of Medicaid in Wisconsin. Under the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, the state is one of 10 that have opted not to do that out of the 50 states. And I think it's a ripe issue for policymakers to examine.
Jason, thank you for the research. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. You know, happy holidays. Happy New Year.
You too. Jason Stein, Vice President and Research Director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.